I Am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A new biography revisits the life and legacy of Julia Child, a superstar author and television personality who brought French cooking to generations. Her television programs are rerun even today, and we see in this new book how she grew and cultivated her celebrity and image, imprinting it in the memories of food lovers and fans for many years. The French Chef in America, Julia Child's second act, is by the author and journalist Alex Prudhomme. He is Julia and Paul Child's great-nephew and the co-author of her biography, My Life in France, which was adapted into the Nora Ephron movie, Julie and Julia. With fairness and affection, he researches the life of Julia Child, her marriage to Paul, and its impact on the public persona. We see how her professional relationships were forged in the world of public television and wider celebrity. We meet people along the way, such as Simone Beck, Simca, a friend and collaborator, as well see how Ms. Child's life intersects with James Beard, Jacques Pepin, and many others. And, of course, the food, the reverence and appreciation of food throughout the book make this read particularly appealing. I'll ask Mr. Prudhomme, who joins me now, about Julia Child's legacy, as well as ask him perhaps for some insight into this larger-than-life lady. Alex Prudhomme's previous books include The Ripple Effect, The Cell Game, and Forewarned. His journalism has appeared in The New York Times, The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Time, and People. The book is published by Appetite, which is an imprint of Random House. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, while here in Vancouver last week, Alex Prudhomme. Mr. Prudhomme, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you are the great-nephew of Paul and Julia Child. Your grandfather, Charles, was Paul's twin, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. Were they close, and not only growing up, but, say, throughout their lives?
Yeah, they were twins, so they were two sides of a coin. My grandfather, Charlie, was a very sort of outgoing, loud, somewhat selfish, entertaining character. And Paul was a quieter, more sort of prickly, internalized person. But they had elements of each other, and they, had a difficult upbringing, and they really learned to rely on each other early on. And when I was helping Julia write her memoir, one of the great resources that we used were the letters that Paul and Charlie and Julia and my grandmother, Frederica, wrote to each other back and forth. Paul and Julia in Paris, my grandparents in Pennsylvania, and they would write every week these wonderful descriptive letters about their lives and, what the what was happening during the Cold War, because Paul worked at the U.S. Embassy, what the price of wine was, what the weather was like, where they went on the weekend, what Julia was cooking, and so on. My grandparents would write them back about their lives in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. So it was really a great resource to have, and you could see the bond between the two brothers.
Yeah, that's the thing that in reading your book got me thinking about. We don't write enough. I mean, you quote these letters that Julia Child would write to Simca, say, and that's really, we write emails, but they're not really the same, are they?
No, and it's something I lament. I mean, going through those letters, it really is a lost art form. And they're so valuable because they are, they're in pristine condition even now. And they're 50-odd years old. Those people are long gone, and yet you see their life force on the page. And so as a writer myself, I really value those, and I lament the effervescence of email.
Yeah. There's some letters that you quote in the book that Julia wrote to Simca. How did you get those? Did she keep copies or?
I don't know how they ended up in her archives. Julia gave her papers and Paul's photographs to the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And there are boxes and boxes of correspondence, along with her book manuscripts and, television scripts and all sorts of things. And I found a whole trove of letters that Julia had written to Simca. So I imagine that Simca kept them and gave them to Julia. because they weren't just carbon copies. Some were, but they were originals. I think that somewhere it may have even been subconscious. They understood the value of what they were doing even before they became well known. You know, her memoir was essentially drawn from those letters and my interviews with Julia.
So Paul and Julia didn't have children. So you and your sisters, you spent a lot of time with them growing up. Is that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they tried to have kids, but as Julia said, it didn't take.
Uh-huh.
And so they treated my sisters and my cousins and myself as sort of surrogate grandchildren. We were very lucky to spend time with them in Cambridge and in Maine, where we have a family house, or at my parents in New York, and then in France, where Paul and Julia built a little house on the edge of Simca's property, right outside of Cannes. And I opened the book with an introduction talking about my first visit to that house, which was called La Pichoune, which means the little thing, in the summer of 76.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during the Montreal Olympics, actually, and we had a real great adventure, and the sort of the pathos of that is that Paul had had a bypass operation in October of 1974 and was still recovering.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of came in and out of focus, as it were, in during our stay there. But the longer we were there, the more he opened up. And by the end of it, he was back to his old self, you know, kind of very entertaining and full of little anecdotes about things. We had some wonderful meals together. But looking back in retrospect, I see that that was sort of the last time I saw the genuine Paul Child,
mm-hmm.
this character that had loomed large in my life. And, you know, he began in a downward slide. And that's one of the stories I tell in this book, is sort of behind the scenes a bit about their personal lives. Julia having a mastectomy, Paul having this bypass, you know, various ailments as they aged. And not to be kind of gossipy about it, but just because, you know, they were human.
Yeah.
And they handled it with as much grace as they could.
And their marriage was, I mean, we know from the influence and support that he gave her, it was a happy marriage, wasn't it?
It was an amazing marriage. And I always caution my friends, don't try to emulate that, because you never will.
Yeah.
They really were devoted to each other. They were very complimentary. And, you know, we dedicated Julia's memoir, My Life in France, to Paul, because she had always said that without Paul, she would not have had her career.
Yeah.
He was, it's interesting how their relationship evolved. For the first half of it or so, he was sort of a senior member. He was 10 years older than she was. He was a sophisticated world traveler. He had lived in France in the 20s, where he knew Hemingway and Gertrude Stein and a lot of the expats. He was fluent in French. He was a real gourmet and knew about wine. He was an artist. And she thought of herself as a, you know, too tall, too loud, kind of country bumpkin dilettante. And he brought her to France, and she discovered her raison d'etre in French cooking and in teaching cookery. And then they retired in 1961,
mm-hmm.
And they kind of reversed roles. Paul very intentionally stepped back from the limelight and put her forward. And the timing is remarkable, you know, that she was really ready to take off at that point.
Yeah.
She had spent years working on that first book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, and so she then became the senior member of the relationship in a way, although he was a crucial component of their joint enterprise behind the scenes. It just worked. It really was remarkable.
Well, I guess the thing that people will wonder the most, is the Julia Child that we saw on television, was she like that off stage, or behind the camera with you guys as kids, say?
Absolutely. I always say that. You know, the Julia you saw on TV was the Julia that I knew as a person. I've met several celebrities, and some of them are like that, and some of them are totally different behind the scenes than their public persona. But Julia was very genuine, and I think that comes through on the television, that she's not faking it. I can't tell you how many times I saw her treat people of very different circumstance in the same way. And for example, there was one night in Santa Barbara when she got a phone call from the White House, and it was someone from George Bush's administration congratulating her on winning the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which was the highest civilian award that an American can get. And she peppered him with questions. Now, who are you, and what do you do? And, you know, poor guy couldn't get a word in edgewise. And then that night I took her to see a movie in downtown Santa Barbara, and her knees were bad, so she was in a wheelchair. And I had to park her on a corner for, literally 3 minutes while I went and got the car. And I came back, and she had met a homeless guy sitting there who had no idea who she was. And she was doing the exact same thing. She was peppering him with questions. And it was just a striking moment to me. Just a great example of how to conduct yourself.
Yeah. A lot of us turn to her on television or her books to learn about food, to learn about cooking. But the one thing that I got from your book is that throughout her life, she remained interested. And she would do the same at a restaurant, say, and ask the waiter or the chef questions. She was always interested in learning.
Absolutely, yeah.
And right up to the end, right?
Oh, yeah. I was with her 2 days before her death, and a lot of the stuff that's at the last few pages of her memoir came from that afternoon when we had lunch with her. And she thought of herself less as a celebrity and more as a teacher of cookery and, as she put it, an eternal pupil. So you're right. She was constantly learning and constantly inquisitive. You were intimating thing that I saw happen many times, but when you'd go out to eat with her, the restaurant would always put you right in the middle of the dining room at the biggest table and to sort of show her off, and people would come up and say hello, and she handled that quite graciously. And then we would go back into the kitchen, and she would want to talk to every single person there, from the head chef, to the salad washer, down to the dishwasher. And she generally knew the head chef's story, and they could talk shop for a bit. But she would spend most of her time with the dishwasher, because she didn't know his or her story. And she was genuinely interested. How did you come to this job, and what's your background? And so I think I learned a lot as a human being and as a journalist by just spending time with her, and just by osmosis, being around her, seeing her in action. She was just a great example.
And what's appealing about her, too, in terms of her view of food, was that she was very democratic in her taste. So, we could have the fancy French stuff, but she also liked a hamburger and fries, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, she's famous for saying how much she loved the McDonald's French fries that were cooked in beef tallow, which I think would give people a heart attack to hear about today. But she loved anything that tasted good. And she wasn't afraid to have a hot dog or a hamburger as long as it was well done,
Yeah. So we mentioned Simca. Her full name, I guess, was Simone Beck, and she was a friend of Julia's going back to her days in France, and they had co-authored the first book. And you talk in this book, the second book, The French Chef in America, about their writing the second volume of that, and just how their professional I guess, friendship or the professional work, I guess, it came apart eventually, right?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Mastering the Art of French Cooking came out in 1961, and a few years later they decided that it was successful enough that they could do Volume 2. So Simca and Julia worked together on Volume 2 of Mastering the Art, and it was a difficult process. And what you have to understand is that they loved each other. They called each other sister, and they would admire each other, but also fight like, you know, blood relatives. Julia was a classic American. She was very practical. She liked to lay recipes out in a logical way. She liked to have exact measurements. She wanted to know all the hows and whys of a dish. Whereas Simca was a classic French woman who was a wonderful, intuitive cook who had tremendous sense of taste, but measured in a, you know, a dash of this and a splash of that. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't really test out her recipes. She would sort of write them up and send them off to Julia, then Julia would make them 10 or 12 times to work out all the kinks. Then Simca would frequently complain later that the recipe that she had written was all wrong, and that, you know, oh, we would never do this in France like this.
Yeah.
You know, Julia was very tolerant of that because she really admired Simca and respected her a lot. But as the deadline approached, she just didn't have the time. They were way behind on their work, and she just had to get it done. And so she sort of stopped reading Simca's letters after a while. And so the book, Mastering the Art, Volume 2, was published in 1970. And after that, they had a parting of the professional ways. I think Simca was somewhat jealous of Julia's success as a multimedia star in America, whereas Simca was in Paris working as a cooking teacher, as she always had. And I think Julia was a little sick of Simca's tirades and capriciousness. But also, on top of that, I think Julia was shifting in a sort of deeper, more fundamental way, experimenting with recipes from other parts of the world, developing a personal voice.
Yeah.
She really does end up creating this second career when she's in the States in the 1970s. After she splits from Simca, she starts to tell these personal stories. She writes in the first person for the first time. She stops performing as the French chef and starts performing as Julia Child. And finally discovers her true voice, which she carried on till the very end of her life. And that's the story that I set out to tell in this new book. Where I come up with my subtitle, which is Julia Child's Second Act, because I never really realized this before, but she really had like a whole second career. And this reinvention happened during the 70s, which was a time of great turmoil in the world, and while Julia was in her 60s. And that alone is remarkable.
Yeah. I was flipping around on the weekend on one of the food channels, and a black and white episode of The French Chef came up. And what was interesting in reading your book was just what was involved in making those shows from, say, the 60s on to the 70s, and how difficult it was really to get those produced. Because, I mean, it was hard work, and it was public television, and it wasn't easy to get a show on the air like that.
That's right, and that's an interesting story that I uncovered. Julia had started at WGBH, which was the local PBS station in Boston. It had been her home for years. She had done hundreds of shows for them, been a very effective fundraiser. Yet, by the late 70s, she was getting sick and tired of their lack of money and lack of organization.
Mm-hmm.
And she felt lack of support for her. So she did sort of the unthinkable. She quit and walked away from public television in order to join Good Morning America, which was a very commercial program. And it was a huge risk, and it was a huge adjustment. She had to turn her 30-minute cooking shows into 3-minute sound bites. Mm-hmm. And accomplish the same mission, you know, to show you how to prepare a dish. And it wasn't easy, but in classic Julia fashion, she managed to reinvent herself, surmount the problem, and turn lemons into lemonade. She ended up having a bigger audience than ever on Good Morning America. So it's the thing that struck me when I was discovering all this was her resiliency. You know, whether it was Paul's bypass operation or reinventing her career, she was always found a way to do it. And I think that can be inspiring for anybody, no matter what your age.
How did she react to the impersonation of by Dan Aykroyd on Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, I got to interview Aykroyd for this book, and he's a terrific guy. Yeah. And really, he loved Julia. He said that that skit where he says "Save the liver," came from a place of deep respect for her, and I think she saw it that way. She kept the videotape of that show on her television and would sometimes break it out, and she would even, after a long dinner party, would tilt her head back and say "Save the liver." So. I think she saw it for what it was, which was an homage to her, and not mean-spirited or anything.
He was
terrific, yeah. Because even now he still respects Julia. So.
Yeah, I learned in your book that his aunt was a big TV star here in Canada.
That's right.
Doing Hélène cooking.
Hélène Goujon,
yeah.
Who was the Julia Child of Canada.
And she's a big deal in this country, but I never made the connection to Aykroyd until your book. So,
yeah. Well, I'm glad I could enlighten you.
Yeah,
there's something for everybody in there.
Indeed, yeah. What also struck me about your book was the I guess we all knew that she was a liberal at heart, and she the staunch liberal, Planned Parenthood, and all that. But you're also frank in the book about certain aspects and fair, I think, about about the homophobia that Paul and Julia sort of displayed. But you also say, you qualify that by saying that they're products of their era.
That's right. Well, they were brought up in a very difficult time, and they were themselves victimized by the McCarthy witch hunt. McCarthy's investigators accused Paul of being a communist and of being a homosexual, it was one of the reasons that he ended up quitting the State Department early, is he just felt that he had sacrificed so much for the government, and then he was turned on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an interesting rift between the old left and the new left. I think Paul and Julia were very much of the old left, whereas the hippies and so on were in the new left. And it was baffling to me to discover what we now would interpret as sort of homophobic slurs that Paul and Julia both used in private. They would never say this stuff in public.
Yeah.
But particularly because they had many of their best friends, including James Beard and MFK Fisher, were either bi or they were gay. I learned from reading Laura Shapiro's book, a short Penguin biography of Julia, that it was thanks to her work with AIDS patients that Julia finally saw the light. And she said, what about those poor people who are dying left and right with no one to care for them? Good food is really important to people like that. And she said, good food is also love. And I think that it just took her a while, coming from that generation, to recognize and understand the situation that many gay people found themselves in.
Yeah. The other thing, the sexism, that there's a story you tell in the book, Sarah Moulton, is that her name?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. That's a great story.
Yeah, and sort of the indifference that I guess Julia Child had with the experience that Sarah had when she was, I guess, in France. Is that right? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah. So Sarah was a young up and coming chef in Boston, and she worked with Julia on the program Julia Child and More Company in 1979, and Julia discovered that Sarah, who's about, she's petite and very youthful looking, but she was a very hard worker and a very good cook. And so Julia mentored her. And in doing so, she sent Sarah on a stage in France where she worked in the kitchen of a one-star restaurant. In kind of classic fashion, the chef was a kind of a chauvinist pig, and he was chasing her around. He tried to corner her in the refrigerator once. He invited her to Paris and kind of harassed her, and she was beside herself. And thought, how could Julia send me to this terrible person, this pig, who treats me like nothing? So she didn't ever say anything to Julia about it at the time. And she ended up sticking it out and learning a lot and having, at the end of the day, just having a very decent learning experience. But she came back to the States and had lunch with Julia and said, Julia, you realize what this guy did? And Julia, without batting an eyelash, said, oh, dearie, get over it.
Yeah.
Sarah was shocked. It seemed like a very unsisterly thing to say. But later, upon reflection, she understood that actually Julia was giving her some very good advice. She called it the best advice that she'd got, which is that details like this guy's piggish behavior really didn't matter. What was important was that Sarah Moulton got to do a stage at a one-star restaurant in France, learned a lot of valuable lessons, and that she should just move on. Don't sweat the small stuff, basically. And it was a lifelong lesson, and she still talks about that today.
She also had her face lifted a couple times, is that right?
Yeah, she did. Yeah. Well, it's the reality of television, which is a visual medium, and Julia was aware that, especially as a woman, you had to look youthful. And so, yes, she did have a couple of facelifts, tried to age as graciously as she could.
Yeah. At the end of the day, when you look at her legacy, I mean, did she really change food in America, or just our, and I include Canada in this because we watched her and read her quite a bit, or did she just change our perception of it?
Oh, I think she did change it, in fact. She made people see that chefs could do all sorts of things, and that food could be many different things, and that that the home cook could accomplish a lot more than he or she thought they could. And so it was a changing of perception that had very real consequences. But at the same time, she would tell her readers and her viewers to demand that the supermarkets carry better produce, which they did, and better cookware, which they did, because if Julia mentioned, leeks or shallots or a garlic press, those things would sell out.
Yeah.
So she had a very profound effect, and she did invent the kind of food revolution that we all experience, but she certainly accelerated the conversation and electrified it, if you will.
Of the people that followed her on television later, because I mean, there are networks now, and in terms of food and people cooking on television, there really isn't someone who inherited the sort of the stature and the ubiquity of Julia Child, is there?
I don't think so, and I don't think there could have been. First of all, she was sui generis. She just had that personality, that effervescent charm and humor combined with deep experience and wonderful technique. Also, once she retired from all of that, it was well established that there was this sort of multimedia culinary circus, you know,
yeah.
That has now become this enormous 24/7 thing that I think she would have had mixed feelings about. You know, on the one hand, glad that people are eating and cooking so much. On the other hand, maybe dismayed at some of the kind of gimmickry of false competitions and sort of melodramatic soap operas, storylines, and so on. And, you know, she thought of cooking as a civilized art, is what she called it.
Yeah.
And she liked the camaraderie and the creativity of cooking. She didn't see it as a competition or as a some kind of
shouting
drama.
Match.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So the first book that you wrote with her, My Life in France, was adapted into the movie that all of us saw, Julie and Julia. In the course of the making of that, did you have any dealings with Nora Ephron at all?
I did. Yeah, I was a consultant on the script, and I was actually an extra in the movie. I appear very briefly, so if you blink, you'll miss me. And I helped to coach Stanley Tucci in playing Paul.
Yeah.
So I did have a role to play, and I think the film really brought Julia to a young audience who may have heard of Julia or not heard of Julia, but really opened people's eyes to her, and used the story of Julie Powell and her husband as a contrast to Julia and Paul, who had this kind of idealized marriage.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it was all about food, so it was great.
So there's a moment in Jacob Bernstein's documentary on Nora Ephron where there's a scene in that movie where Meryl Streep and Jane Lynch linger at a full-size mirror looking at each other, and someone in the movie, in the documentary, says that really, I guess, epitomized Nora Ephron's relationship with her sisters. For you, having known Paul and Julie as well as you did, was there a moment in Stanley Tucci's depiction of Paul and Meryl Streep's of Julia that because there's some beautiful moments between the two of them in the film, that sort of really reminded you of them and seeing them again, say?
Yes, but it's very hard for me, of all people, because I was so kind of intimately involved in both the real life and the fictionalized life. You know, when there are certain moments, intimate moments, when they're together, this made me laugh or recognize. I think they got very close to the actual Paul and Julia. And, you know, I love the scenes when they're in their Paris apartment together, for example. And there's some funny ones, like when Julia's chopping this huge mound of onion.
Yeah.
And Paul comes up the stairs, and he doesn't even say anything. He just starts tearing up from the onions and walks away, and you know, using the hearts that they made for Valentine's Day. Even the poignant moment where they realize that Dorothy, Julia's younger sister, is having kids and they can't conceive, and little moments like that I think a lot of viewers related to, but I especially did.
Yeah. Well, you've done a great service bringing us this remarkable woman and Paul too to people's minds with this book and of course My Life in France. I appreciate your time today. Congratulations with the book and continued good luck with it, Alex.
Well, merci, Joseph, and bon appétit.
The book is called The French Chef in America, Julia Child's Second Act. It's published by Appetite, which is an imprint of Random House. Its author, Alex Prudhomme, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.